Good evening, everybody. I'm Patrick from the Poison Pen, and it's always a treat and an honor to have my good friend Ace Atkins here with us to discuss his new book, Robert B. Parker's Someone to Watch Over Me, which Barbara is holding up. Ace, welcome. It's great to see you, as always.
It's good to see you guys, too. I'm sad that I'm not there in person. I miss our visits a lot, but this is a traditional part of the Spencer tour or the Quinn tour, is seeing you guys. So this is nice.
Yeah. We're delighted to see you. I was sad to see in something today, a reminder that Bob died in January of 2010. And I thought, wow, how has this much time elapsed? I mean, it was like yesterday that he was here on a regular basis. So it's been a blow, but thank you for continuing the series, because there's so much in it to love, so many characters. And it's a tribute to Pearl, because I want to start out talking about Pearl. I have a picture of my dog on the couch, but luckily she won't bark because this is a photograph.
As I mentioned to Patrick earlier, I was a little bit worried about the dog. I thought the dog maybe had had a stroke. I thought maybe that you had stuffed the dog. I thought something had gone wrong. Patrick mentioned that you'd gotten into taxidermy, so I'm glad to know that it's a virtual background.
It is a virtual background, which is why things sort of waver. I want to apologize to those of you who are watching for our somewhat late start. It was a catastrophic failure at my end in getting Zoom going. But anyway, we have achieved it. So speaking of dogs, let's talk a little bit about the new Pearl, a baby Pearl. And I looked up a German short-haired pointer so I could envision this puppy that you have introduced into the lives of Spencer and Susan.
Well, one of the things I want to continue with the Spencer books is having a little personal piece of, you know, not only, you know, with my own life, but also keeping contact with the Parkers. And Joan Parker, Bob's wife, was a dear friend of mine. She was a wonderful, wonderful supporter of this whole thing happening, of continuing Spencer. This was Joan's idea. And so part of that is the idea of how Bob would always have a new Pearl in real life. And I think he had three or four Pearls. And I was just intrigued of the way that when one Pearl would pass away, he would get a new Pearl, and there was a system to it. And Barbara, do you know about this? Did Bob ever talk about that with you?
He did.
And he had this system that I think it was, I got to know a little bit about this through his best friend, Mel Farman, who became a dear friend of mine as well and helped me research the books, is he said Bob would wait about 2 weeks after Pearl had passed away, and then he would check in the want ads for dogs or wherever you look for German short-haired pointers. And he had a system of saying, that's the dog. That was the dog that was born exactly 2 weeks after Pearl passed away. And then he would drive, I think, as far as Canada or up, you know, go to upstate New York. And he would see a litter of puppies, and he would figure out who was the Pearl. It was like the Dalai Lama, and he would bring the dog back. And so I love that story. And I don't think it was ever really necessarily talked about a lot in the Spencer books, but I wanted to bring that slice of the Parker life to Spencer. And that's what this is all about.
Well, it adds a lot of charm and humor to the fact that Susan doesn't really want to accept this new Pearl so easily. So for Susan, it's the puppy. And, you know, Spencer has to spend part of his time training the dog. The dog doesn't like being caged, whatever. But the other thing I like about it, Ace, and you do this a bit with Spencer too, when you refer to him a few times in the text here as old man, as he's about to take down, you know, several thugs in one blow or however he does it.
Right.
Is that you're reminding us that, you know, this is a long-term series and things have aged, people die, dogs die. Sadly, dogs do not live as long as people, which I think is a real tragedy.
I agree. Yeah. Both animal lovers. I think that and I have three dogs, and I couldn't do what I do without having the company of the animals. But it's interesting. It's a delicate balance to keep Spencer going and to keep him believable, but yet keep him rooted in the modern world. And I think the only thing I've really tried to do, one of the things I've tried to do with Spencer is to make sure that he is aging a little bit. And I think I aged him more than Bob did. I think that Bob had Spencer perpetually in fine fighting shape at about maybe early 50s. You know, he still was running 4 to 5 miles. He still was bench pressing 275, 16 times. He was doing that. And I like the idea, almost coming from, again, kind of an inspiration that Bob found with the Westerns. And it's kind of the idea of an aging gunfighter. And that's who I see Spencer right now. I see Spencer somewhere in his 60s. I think he's lost a step maybe a little bit. I think he's got some injuries, but it makes it more endearing to me. So even though I'm not aging him in real time, I have aged him a little bit more than Bob did.
Well, you did out there. He's still really working out. I mean, he and Hawk have a workout, at least one, you know, in the gym, in the old boxing room that,
quitting. They're not quitting. They're not giving up. They're still keeping fit.
So here's another question. If Spencer is aging slightly, how about Hawk?
They're both aging, but the funny thing is, it's not really funny, Barbara. It's not funny to me, but when I first started writing these books, I started thinking about an older Spencer and the way he would feel. And then Spencer doesn't get that much older, but I get older. So now I'm aging into the character. Now I'm aging into being about Spencer's age. And at some point I will surpass him, I guess. But the things I used to write about 10 years ago about having a knee ache or having old football injuries because Spencer was an old college football player or things like that, I would write about them theoretically, but now not so much anymore. I don't find them as amusing.
Well, I really sympathize with you. Patrick watched me hobble yesterday. I have an injury sustained at Canyon Ranch on our spa vacation, and I'm sitting here with an ice pack against my muscle, and I'll be lucky to stand up when this is over. So
you do what you got to do.
Well, you know, there are certain indignities that come with age, and you know, I've learned to just kind of accept them because there's nothing I can do about them. Anyway, you really took this book, you have ripped this one literally out of headlines. I mean, I think not only, well, maybe the Steiner guy is not quite Jeffrey Epstein, but certainly you have upped the, for Ghislaine Maxwell, you have actually made Poppy in this book more Ghislaine than Ghislaine might actually be. So why did you decide to do that?
I agree. Yeah, that story was just so crazy. And I think that I would be reading these stories about, Maxwell and things were going with Jeffrey Epstein. And they were so unbelievable. And I think really the biggest thing was the abuse of power. The fact that, you know, a district attorney in Florida would actually throw a case, and the fact that he wasn't punished for any of these things, or the fact that people in law enforcement were harassed for just investigating him. And he had so much money, so much power that he could skate around all this stuff. And it was like a little conduit into another universe where people have this kind of money, they can do what they want to. And the more that I read about it, the more angry that it got me. And the more that I thought about, I wonder what Spencer would think about this. And I wonder what Spencer and Hawk would do about something like this. And, you know, that's the beauty of the private detective. That's the beauty of crime fiction is, you know, we can do things more immediately. We can do things within the confines of 350 pages. You know, unfortunately for somebody like Epstein, it took, 25, 30 years for him to finally, you know, get his due and to finally have his day in court. So that's where it came from. But no, I mean, the parallels, I make no distinction between the Epstein case and this. I mean, it's absolutely inspired by it.
Well, we should probably talk about how we enter into this case. So tell us about Maddie Sullivan. Remind us of who she is. You referenced the fact that maybe 10 years ago, Spencer helped her the murder of her mother was what brought them together. So how old is she now?
Maddie's, you know, she was 14 in Lullaby, so she's 24 years old. And I wanted to connect back to the earlier books. You know, I've been doing this, it seems like just the other day I was coming in and having explained to people how I was chosen by the Parker estate and how Joan Parker and I had decided how to do Spencer and that kind of thing. And now we've come around, now it's been almost 10 years of writing the same character. So things that I wrote about 10 years ago, it's time to revisit. And the one thing that I really want to do, I talk about this all the time, but I hope when you pick up one of the Spencer novels that I've written, that it's got a good enough story that it would be readable and exciting to somebody without Spencer's involvement. And that's my criteria for these books. I want somebody to pick up these novels and enjoy it. If it was John Smith or it was simply about the crime, is it interesting if you don't mention Spencer's in it? I mean, I don't want to do just a run-of-the-mill mystery, murder, whatever, and it's exciting because it's Spencer. I want it to be a something that could be a standalone story. So the genesis of writing Spencer and how I started writing Lullaby, the first one after Mr. Parker died, was I had helped out, 12, 15 years ago with a group here in Oxford, Mississippi called the Innocence Project. And they look into people that are wrongly accused, or they believe them to be wrongly accused that are on death row. And I was particularly interested in a young woman that I met who was about 13, 14 years old. Her mother had been murdered and there was a man that was on death row for the crime. And she completely believed that he did not do it, that he was wrongly accused, and that there was somebody out there that had killed her mother. And that story just stuck with me, and it really resonated. I met this woman. I actually helped out a little bit on the case. I actually helped do some, just to help out with some of the footwork, that kind of thing. And so when they asked me to create what would be the first Spencer after Bob died, that was the best story I had. And so now flipping to where we are now, I wondered where she was now and where is Maddie Sullivan now? And for me, this was just, again, the perfect entry point to write kind of a Jeffrey Epstein type story.
Well, Bob was always good at bringing forth, characters that he had previously introduced. Sure. And keep it going. And this book is in Spencer characters. I mean, we have Rita Fury who gets involved, and then she's given up, I guess, some extent seducing Spencer. So she's, I'm trying to remember which of the guys Rita's now involved with.
Which one of her boyfriends or
which one? Well, part of the Spencer verse, but Rita says to Spencer in this book at some point that she's
really infatuated by Spencer's protege, Sixkill.
She
kind of moved up the food chain as far as his Rita would say his hunkiness.
Right. So we have Sixkill, we have Rita, then we have Lieutenant Kirk because we need the Boston PD involved in this one. We have the guy in Florida that has been in before. Then we have Susan. We have Baby Pearl.
Yeah.
It's we have Hawk. Hawk is a big part in this book, and he doesn't always, but it's really good to see Hawk. We won't talk about endings, but I like the way Hawk goes. And then at some point you bring back an old nemesis, but how do we get there?
Well, again, I think the one thing that I'm a fan of these books, and I'm a fan of Robert B. Parker. And when I was asked if I would contribute pages and be interested in continuing the Spencer books, I was thrilled to do it. And Parker's longtime editor, Chris Pepe, asked me, could she send me a box of books? Could I get familiar with the character by reading the backlist? And I told her, I said, Chris, I said, I love these books so much. They're wrapped in Mylar. I have first editions. I said, I know Parker inside out. I said, this is how I got to write my own series. This is why I became a crime writer. But I think what people really want, or what I want as a fan, is continuity. And that's what I try to bring to these books, is I don't want to put my personal stamp on it. I'm not trying to put the ASAC and spin on these books. I'm really trying to, I want people to feel like they read a Parker book and they read a book that I wrote, it's the same world, it's the same characters. And so from time to time, as Parker would do, he created these wonderful characters. Maddie Sullivan is my creation, but characters like, Quirk have been around forever since the beginning. Susan Silverman, which I love to write for, Hawk, we want to see how this stuff plays out. We want to revisit old friends. And so that's what I hope I've done over the last 10 years now, which I can't believe it's been 10 years, is hopefully bring a continuity to this world.
Well, I think that's true. But what you have is such a rich number of characters. You can't throw them all into every single book. It would just get bogged down. So it's interesting to see which ones you select, for which story. and sure. And all the ones that you've pulled forth, I think, in Someone to Watch Over Me, you know, fit the story.
I think so too. I think that you know, people have, you know, sometimes I get letters from people of, hey, the last two books haven't had Hawk in it. Where's Hawk? But Hawk is such a great character. You want them to want him to come back. You know, it's like, you know, it's like somebody doing an encore performance. You want people to be, you know, wanting Hawk so bad. I'm like, okay, well, Hawk is going to come back. And Bob did that too. I mean, Hawk was not in every book. He had a great cast of characters, and they're so rich and so wonderful. And he just had just that great light touch, and especially drawing those wonderful characters so exactly that, again, I've said this every time that we've talked, every time, this is the ninth Spencer that we've been talking about. It's a testament to Bob Parker that he created these characters. People want more of them. And there's thousands, millions of books like this, but what a testament to his skill that we're still talking about him now, 10 years later.
Well, it really is. I'm trying to remember, was it actually 1975 that the Godwolf manuscript published? I think it was
1973, 72.
Was it? Tony Hillerman came on the scene right after. I may be thinking of Hillerman for 75, I have read him in real time. I mean, I well remember when the Godwolf manuscript published, you know, because, I mean, I bought one. I still own one. Thank God. If you think about it, I mean, how long has that been? 1973, and we're in 2021. That's an enormous span of years.
And it's a crazy thing to think about. People still want more. And I do think, you know, and I had the same experience. I remember, I can't remember how I got into it. I think Parker was so popular in the 80s. I read maybe Crimson Joy when it had first come out. And I like to read books in order, as many of your readers do and people that are coming to the store. And so I went back and I found a copy, which I might have around here somewhere. My paperback's back there. My original copy that I got of the Godwolf manuscript, which was the original Berkeley paperback from the early 70s. And it changed my life. It did. I was a reader at that point. I was a big reader. I think at that point I'd been reading primarily like spy fiction, John le Carré and that kind of stuff, Ian Fleming. And I read Godwolf manuscript and I was like, this is what I want to do. These are the kind of books I want to read. This is the kind of books I want to write. And they're it's a wonderful book. It's a classic.
Well, Bob was so fabulous at dialogue. I never minded, you know, all the white space and the big margins and so forth that made his books look bigger in print than they actually were in terms of words, because every word really mattered. And, you know, sometimes I would get bogged down and I would have like a whole raft of books and I'd think, oh, you know, got to read all these for various purposes. And then there would always be that siren song from the Robert Parker manuscript sitting over there, you know, and it would say, read me now. And so whenever I felt like I, you know, needed a lift in the middle of it all, I would take the Parker out sometimes 2 or 3 months out of sequence. And I would read it because it was always just, it was just so much fun.
They're all so much fun. And I think that's the secret to the longevity. First of all, the Parker books are, he was a beautiful writer. And I don't think he gets enough credit for that. I think that, you know, people talk about the private eye and the mystery, whatever. But I think that I think Bob has said in many interviews, what people came back for was the language. And he was a poet. He was a trained poet. And I learned so much from him about writing and the detail work and the rhythm of sentences. And it's lovely to watch. But the humor is why we love it. I mean, especially right now. I mean, during a pandemic and political upheaval and everything that were going on, I mean, I can't read a heavy-handed book. I just can't do it. I don't want to read anything that's not any fun. But I know, you know, I could go back to the back list of Parker's and pick up a book and I know I'm going to laugh. I know I'm going to have a fun time. And I think that's what the humor is what separated him.
There's a new genre creeping up on us, it got a name for me the other day. Dana Stabenow, who's staying with me right now, refers to it as nihilism, especially British nihilism. And it's kind of an outgrowth of the domestic suspense, you know, where everybody betrays everybody else. But this new one is called the Bad Seed drama. And, you know, it revolves around children who, or families where children are either abused or children are turn out to be monsters or whatever. And I just can't read them. I mean, I had to read two in a row and I thought, you know, I am not doing this right now. It is so, it makes me want to dive into a Georgette Hare or a Spencer or, you know, completely get away.
Well, I mean, you know, Bob goes back, obviously, you know, famously to bring back the spirit of Chandler. And that's what he did in the early 1970s when people thought the private eye was dead and there was not going to be any more except for, you know, Ross McDonald. But really, he reinvigorated the genre. And what he did was bringing back that world-weary private eye. And that point of view of, think about the time that he was writing during Vietnam, during the Nixon era, during people mistrusting authority. It was not a good time. And what I think Spencer did and what Chandler did with Marlowe is the world is an imperfect place and it is a dark place. And there are evil men that are among us, but it doesn't mean that they have to put shadows among our enjoyment of life. And you can find humor in people. You can make fun of them. You can find enjoyment where you can. And that's really, I think, the heart of what makes Parker for me. That's what makes Chandler. And that's the thing that in dark times, we find enjoyment and we find light. And that's the positive message of all these books. They're not just, you know, it's not about who killed who and what happened. I don't care about that. I don't really care about that at all. It's mainly, a philosophy.
And you want justice served regardless of, you know, it may not be precise, may not be legal justice, but you always want Parker, you know, go to Parker to know that there will be a conclusion.
Absolutely. And it goes back to what I was talking about with Epstein is I was so frustrated. The more I would learn about Jeffrey Epstein and learn more about the corruption and the way that, you know, a state attorney in Florida completely let this guy skate. And the fact that, you know, when he did serve time, it wasn't for, you know, for being a pedophile and for sex trafficking. It was because they said that he was running prostitutes, and it was a insult to the fact that he was recruiting underage girls. It was just insane. And the more I read about it, I just thought, how did it take 25 more years for people to listen to these women, to listen to these young girls that happened? And, you know, that's what we can find in crime fiction. It's not always the real world. A lot of times it happens a lot faster than it does in the real world, but at least we do have some kind of justice, some kind of resolution. And that makes us feel good for a little while.
I want to come back to Parker and Chandler in a moment, but since you brought come back to someone to watch over me, let's talk for a moment about how it gets started. So Maddie, age 24, what would she say? Is she a protege? She's sort of trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life. And so she appears in Spencer's office and, you know, she wants to talk things through, but she doesn't want him to take over. She wants to actually handle this case herself. And so he's kind of in the role, or at least starts out in the role of backup rather than, you know, backup for Maddie to see what she can do with it rather than just taking over. That's hard for him, isn't it?
I think so. And I think it's very hard when you're talking about the span of almost 50 books to do something kind of unusual or different or put Spencer, who is still Spencer, in a different role. And for this one, playing backup or playing second fiddle to another investigator is not necessarily something we've seen in earlier books. But I think that he does appreciate Maddie so much and he respects Maddie so much because she is such a tough character and she has been through so much that he wants to allow her to possibly fail and possibly trip up a little bit. And he wants to be able to be there to provide some guidance. I think I always thought about, you know, some of these characters that I've continued writing about, like Maddie Sullivan or Six Killer or whatever. You know, I think about Maddie Sullivan, I think about her, could be her own book. You know, she could have a young adult series. I could have seen what she's been doing over the last 10 years, basically being an amateur, you know, sleuth in South Boston. I would love to read, I don't have time to do it. I don't have time to write those books, but I'd love to, I kind of envision what her world was like. And of course, a lot of this comes from, you know, I love pop culture. I love, you know, classic novels and you know, Patrick and I have talked about this many times is, you know, some of this goes back to even classic Westerns. And so a lot of Maddie Sullivan goes back to True Grit, and having a young girl like True Grit with Maddie Ross, hiring an old hired grizzled hand like Rooster Cogburn to track down the men that, you know, in that case killed her father. So I try to draw on not only things of classic crime fiction, but also Westerns that were, very important to Bob as well.
But this wasn't Parker's first rodeo in dealing with a youngster and trying to straighten out their life. Let's go all the way back to Early Autumn, which wasn't that like the fourth Parker, fourth or fifth?
That was the fourth, yeah.
I think it was the fourth. And, you know, the young boy that he he takes him as a project. And, so he's done this before, kind of mentoring or inspiring someone who doesn't know where their life is going or who might get lost for good or whatever. Maddie is not as badly off, I think, as the young boy of whose name I can't remember.
Yeah, Paul Jackman. And with Paul Jackman.
Paul, right, Paul Jackman.
Paul was a kid that was kind of shiftless, kind of soft. He couldn't find any kind of focus. He could not, find his center, so to speak. And I think that Maddie really, what I tried to do was the exact opposite of Paul. Mm-hmm. She was tenacious. She was tough. She was almost too hardened. And so in one book, in Early Autumn, basically Spencer's trying to toughen up Paul to become a man. And with Maddie, he's trying to, make her back off to just to be able to enjoy life and not look at life in such a hard way by taking care of her younger siblings, by trying to find out what happened to her mother and looking from a very jaded point of view. So it's all a continuing story. It's all things that were inspired by Parker, but again, just trying to take a new spin on things.
I always thought that Bob was a really good dad. I never saw him with his boys, but Bob was a big, burly, boxer, athletic and all that. Yeah. And I always thought that both his sons are gay. And yeah. Bob was perfectly fine with that. He was so proud of them and talked about it and all in a time when before it was as easy to discuss that as it is today. I've always admired that.
Bob was absolutely on the forefront of things. And we talk about things, and I wrote about this in an essay that I wrote about Spencer, Spencer was, and Parker was very socially conscious at a time that these things were not easy. And even things that we take for granted. I mean, how many times have we seen the white guy and the black guy team up in a buddy comedy? We've seen it 100 times. But really for Bob to write about this in Boston, which is one of the race, I mean, I'm sitting here talking from Oxford, Mississippi, but one of the most racist places in America in Boston was quite a unique thing to have him with a black ally and to have them join forces of equal. And the same way that he would populate the books with gay characters, that was something you didn't see. And you certainly didn't see in crime fiction. And you certainly didn't see in tough guy fiction. And, what I read from that, especially being a younger person as a teenager, he wrote about all kinds of people from different walks of life, whether they're gay or straight, black or white. And I think that's really the great legacy of Robert Parker. Which is the tolerance and the acceptance for, all people. And, it really is a lovely message, and it's a hell of a message coming from a hard-boiled writer.
It is indeed. And he lived it in real life as well, not just in his books, which is one thing I truly admired. So what happens is, I keep dragging us back to getting started in this book, is that Maddie has, there's a young girl that has a story that has outraged Maddie. The young girl was invited for $500 to go to a club and do a massage, massage a guy's feet. Well, right there, you realize that this could never have been good. Way too much money for the job and so forth. But anyway, after the inevitable occurs and she flees, leaving her backpack behind, and the backpack really is a pivot in this story, because if Peter Steiner, the Epstein character, had just given back the backpack, that might have been the end of it. But no, he was not going to do it. He was going to show whatever power he had. And that was, that it's like a MacGuffin, really, in this book, is that, Spencer's not going to, that's not going to be okay. He's going to help Maddie retrieve this stuff for this girl. And in the process, here's other girls' stories and realizes that there is a multitude of victims, and it all just kind of snowballs. But that was so Parker, you know, in his books, or so Spencer, really, you know, he just kind of banged things up, or, you know, knocked some balls around and then saw what happened. And then from that chaos or whatever it was that happened when he started that, he would follow it wherever it went. So there was an organic quality to his investigations. They weren't really methodical like a police investigation. They were more, you know, bang things and see what happens and then follow that.
Sure. No, I mean, I think that comes from so many times with Spencer, who just bothers the hell out of people until somebody gets unnerved and makes a mistake, you know. But yeah, I think it goes back to, you know, the whole thing with like the laptop and, you know, this, what had happened to this young girl. I mean, that story that I recount in there happened with Jeffrey Epstein 100,000 times, of him recruiting a teenage girl for supposedly a massage or companionship or whatever, and then for them to get sexually assaulted. And that happened so many times, it's mind-boggling how long it took him to be arrested. And so Spencer is famously, we talk about all the time, is he has a moral code that he believes in. And there is not a lot of gray area with right or wrong, you know. And I think that, again, what makes Spencer so relevant these days is, you know, we see all this discussion, right? You know, what is right and wrong? What's up and what's down? What is ethical and unethical? I mean, it's not debatable for Spencer. You know, for Spencer, it's very clear, you know, there are bad guys and there's good guys, and there's the right thing to do and there's the wrong thing to do. And this is definitely something that, you know, especially the treatment of children, that really infuriates him. And you know, when Maddie can't quite get to the center of it, she agrees to let Spencer join her in this investigation.
Well, Spencer's all about accountability. Equality sadly lacking at the moment. And I've always really appreciated that. So the thing I found most horrifying actually in this book was less Peter Steiner, because I mean, we do know those kinds of characters exist. It was Poppy and her grooming. The way that Poppy actually went out and recruited these girls, groomed these girls, even participated, that I found so completely horrifying.
I wish I could say that was fictional. I wish I could say that was something I
well, it's not, obviously not.
Exactly, that happened, and that happens a lot with, the weird thing with Maxwell and with Epstein, with what had happened, was her you know, procuring of these young girls to come in and be with him. It was just the weirdest damn crazy arrangement. And she was as complicit, you know, as anybody. And she was his partner in the recruitment of these girls. And it was just the strangest damn operation. There's a terrific podcast that I would encourage people, if they would like to learn more about the actual case that inspired this. There's a podcast on ABC News that really goes the ins and outs of how the Epstein investigation happened and how long it took for him to get to justice. But it is a weird, twisty story. And it was just something that, for me, it seemed like the perfect kind of story for Spencer to enter into.
And there's a very strange publishing tie too, in the sense that Ghislaine Maxine, the daughter of Robert Maxwell, who, you know, either committed suicide or whatever happened anyway. Yeah. A suspicious death, collapse of a financial empire. But at the same time, in publishing, he had real repercussions. That is the moment in which Scribner ended as a independent publisher and became part of Simon & Schuster.
I did
the
not
Scribner,
know that.
Oh yeah, Robert Maxwell owned Scribner.
I didn't
know. And it was a...
I knew about his suspicious death and, you know, falling off the, or whatever happened, falling off the yacht or whatever, but I did not know the tie to Scribner. It's very, very interesting.
Oh yeah, no, it was, you should talk to Otto about it, because Otto had a distribution agreement that got completely screwed up in all of that. So there were a lot of repercussions from Robert Maxwell's death, but the fact that he had this shady life and suspicious death, and this is his daughter. And I wondered in part if, because Maxwell was so rich and she had such a privileged life, that when he died and it all went kerblooey, if she, you know, Epstein offered her something that she had lost that she couldn't regain on her own. And that was the real corrupting factor in it.
I don't think it would take Susan Silverman with a degree in psychology from Harvard to point her in that direction. I think a lot has been made about the fact that her her posh lifestyle and her ties to many rich and famous people, including the royal family, that kind of thing, is that she wanted to continue living that. I don't think she was she had a shortage of money, but I think it was just the connection to fame and to power. And the level, you realize that with stories like Epstein, there are people that live in a level of wealth and power that's hard for the rest of us to really to imagine. Having your own private island, being completely separated from the law, hanging out with presidents and rock stars and actors. And this guy lived, he could do whatever he wanted to. And it was almost like a, almost like a Roman lifestyle. And it seems it's one of those stories, almost, again, stranger than fiction.
Indeed so. I'm going to bring Patrick into this discussion, but I wanted to ask you, I've never thought about it well, and all the times that you and I have done events together, and I think we've been together, the three of us, or in some formation, for everything you've ever written, haven't we?
That's right.
All the way from Crossroads Blues, because Patrick, you were such a champion of Crossroads Blues
There was only 100 copies sold of Crossroads Blues, and I think Patrick sold 99 of them.
I think he probably did. But what I wanted to ask you was, because you reminded me that Parker actually wrote, I'm trying to remember, 2 Raymond Chandler continuations. I know he wrote 1, but was it 2 or 3? I can't remember the total.
Poodle Springs and...
Springs, right? And then
I think the sequel to The Big Sleep that he also wrote as well. Poodle Springs was excellent. I mean, he did a great job. And that's always my stock answer when people ask me. They said, well, how would Parker feel about this, about continuing Spencer? And I said, well, he continued Philip Marlowe, so I guess he was okay with it.
Right. But I wondered, I thought, Patrick, have you read the 2 Chandler continuations that Parker wrote?
I think I read, I did read Poodle Springs. I think I bogged down in the second one, Perchance to Dream. But I should give it another shot.
Yeah, I had the same experience. I think Poodle Springs felt almost effortless Chandler. I mean, nobody knew Raymond Chandler inside out the way that Parker did. I mean, let's face it. I mean, Spencer is the reincarnation of Philip Marlowe. The first book, he was very tied in with the Chandler style. And I think the last book, he was a little bit more just kind of doing Bob Parker with those characters. They're both great. They're both terrific.
There was a fragment too of Poodle Springs, and there wasn't of Perchance to Dream, right?
Yeah, that's right. There was such a little, I want to say there's only like 10 or 12 pages with Poodle Springs, and he was writing it when he died. And then they hired him to do it. And it's a terrific book. It ended up making into like an HBO movie with James Caan. I thought he, let's face it. I mean, Spencer is, there's so much Philip Marlowe in him.
Oh yeah, no, totally. So Patrick, you probably have questions from Facebook to direct.
Yeah, I do have a few. Let's see here. Jonathan asks, it was interesting to see Spencer called, to hear Spencer called old man. Where do you see Spencer going in future years? Is there an end?
I hope not. I think that Spencer has entered that kind of category, maybe like Marlowe, maybe like James Bond, that we're going to see him. He's kind of entered that stratosphere of being a character that we're going to be hearing about. Other people will write Spencer. There'll be a Spencer graphic novel. There will be another Spencer movie. And I just think he captured the imagination of people. I think there'll be any type of incarnation. But as far as me, I don't necessarily see a time Spencer is retiring, but we'll see. We'll see.
I got a little note from Steve Schwartz. He wanted me to make sure to say hi to you. He's always part of the gang that's here, and we go out always, and have dinner. And
always, I miss our visits for sure.
Right. Let's see here. Well, a lot of people are watching and just commenting on how much they like your stuff. I'll wait for some more actual questions, but I wanted to get back to the notion of of the code and how important that is. And don't you think that perhaps right now in this time that we're living in, people are attracted to that? You know, they're attracted to a code, you know, in this kind of, you know, hazy morality. And, you know, we're just inundated with these kind of stories, you know, examples of its opposite, you know, that somebody that has integrity, that has a code, that has, you know, that sort of classic character. Well, I think people, Patrick, there's a real demand for that.
I think that there, I hope so. And I think that, you know, you kind of are thinking about as a writer, you know, what is the point of me writing? Am I trying to entertain? Am I trying to inform? What am I trying to do? And I think that I'm really trying to carry on a tradition that goes back to Hammett and Chandler, you know, and to Robert B. Parker in my own books with Quinn Colson, or, you know, continuing on with Spencer, is about a man of honor that lives in immoral times. And we are living in highly immoral times, and not to go too far off that, but we know that. We know exactly how things are insane at the moment. You know, it goes back, I'll never forget when I was in, got a young guy in high school, and back before Turner Classic Movies, I got to see High Noon and got to see Gary Cooper as Will Kane, and looking as there was a job to do, there was a right and there was a wrong, and there was the Frank Miller and his gang were coming to town, and people were straddling the line as far as what to support. And of course, you know, it was something that was a, you know, discussion of what was going on with blacklisting in Hollywood, and we know that now. But I was just drawn to that story, even not knowing as far as what was going on with the McCarthy hearings, as far as people were faced with a dilemma of a right and wrong clarity. There was a clear moral path, and there was Gary Cooper walking down down that street, listening to you know, the wonderful score. And you know, you thought, you know, with Tex Ritter, and you're thinking to yourself, you know, it's so clear what is the right thing to do. And I think that if Bob Parker was sitting here with me right now, we would be in absolute agreement, is we're trying to continue on that tradition. Is I think maybe people need a reminder of who they are and what to do, and maybe a reminder as far as what is the code to live by. I don't find it very tricky, and I don't find it very tricky when I watch High Noon, who is the hero in this, and who are the bad guys, and who are the people that straddle both sides because they don't want to get involved. And often for me, those people are the worst, the worst people that don't want to make any type of statement of who they are. But again, I think that's what, you know, that's what draws me to these kind of stories.
It's interesting.
I'm sorry, Patrick, I'm not going to be able to sit still any longer. So I'm going to abandon the two of you to polish this up and talk about July and the Quinn Colson. But I forgot, when I was holding up this beautiful book, which I really like, and which unfortunately because of the screen wobbles, to mention that we have autographed copies that Ace very kindly signed them at home in Oxford, Mississippi, and they have arrived at the store. And this is a wonderful opportunity for you to get a real signed book.
And there are not many places that are doing this either. You were one of the very few that are doing actually hand-signed editions. So I would definitely send anyone your way to, is it poisonpen.com? Is that?
Yep, poisonpen.com. It's important to spell it with the ED.
Yeah.
Right. In any case, I am going to take my ice pack and remove myself while I can stand up. And say thank you, Ace, very much. Patrick, I hope that you'll talk to Ace more, and also about July and the Quinn Colson book. So thank you very much. It's wonderful to see you, Ace. And I think if you can even drive here in July and we don't all melt into the pavement, it'll be a great chance to reconnect.
I'll take the books to Oxford.
Well, there's another thought. Maybe we could send Patrick to you. Good idea.
Both invited. Come to Faulkner Land anytime.
Would love to. I actually have my paternal relatives are from Laurel, Mississippi, and I've never been there.
Come on.
So it might be a really good idea. In any case, sure. Happy New Year, Ace, and thank you once again. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Yeah. Well, it's funny. I we don't have too much time left, but we have some good questions starting to come in. But I wanted let's see here. You're talking about, you know, when Parker first arrived on the scene, And it was in the middle of this, of the Vietnam era, you know, highly polarized, politicized landscape. And, you know, very different than the crime fiction that was coming just post-World War II, you know, when everybody was united against a common foe. You know, and after in the Vietnam period, you had, you know, the Richard Starks. You had a lot of characters that were on the opposite side of the law. You know, the criminal as the good guy, as the protagonist.
Yeah, the anti-heroes.
Right. And we have a lot of that today, too, in a sense. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but it's, you know, tumultuous eras kind of inspire these different kinds of characters.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to see more of that too, Patrick. I think we're going to see more and more. I think the idea of necessarily the, you know, the square hero might be a little bit outdated these days. So it'll be interesting to see what these times end up, you know, what we end up getting.
Yeah, there's we've had a couple of questions that refer to, let's see, Brett asks, how much does visiting Spencer locations add to your writing? I know you've made a lot of trips to Boston, pilgrimages to check it out, and obviously you can't do that this year, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been doing this so long, I've been doing this for 10 years now, that I kind of know Boston like the back of my hand. I know all the different neighborhoods. I spend a lot of time there. I will say, let me take a little time out to say, this is the first time that I'm launching a book without a man named Mel Farman. And Mel Farman was a very dear friend to me, and he was Bob Parker's best friend for almost 50 years. And when I was, given the opportunity to continue Spencer, Mel helped me so much, not only understand Spencer, but understand Boston and help me research. We used to go to everywhere. See where the Gillette Stadium, where the Pats played for Cheap Shot. We ended up doing, we'd go to these diners and Revolutionary War battlefields and all over these places that, you know, Bob used to frequent, or places that were unique to my particular story. I think there were some really bad neighborhoods that I wanted to go see that Mel said, "You're on your own, kid." I think there was even one time that we ended up at a notorious, or I know we did, we ended up at this notorious Boston strip club called the Golden Banana. And, you know, Mel went there with me, and we went there because it was part of the story. So it adds to the authenticity. This was the only one of the few years that I was writing a book where I could not visit some of the locations. And in particular for this, the end of the book takes place in the Bahamas. And I had the plans, you know, I think I actually chose the Bahamas because I was like, you know, the new Spencer book, it ends up in the Bahamas, so I'm going to have to go to the Bahamas, you know, but I didn't get to visit there. So this is one of the first times I wrote about an area that I had not been to, but luckily I connected with some Bahamians that were very helpful to me and hopefully got the details right.
Joe asks, he says, Bob Parker used to focus on Spencer's cooking. Is Ace averse to doing that?
No, I have cooking in all of the books. I have a small, you know, I want the books to always feel exactly the way they did as far as the way that the Parker was writing them. One of the few details that I've changed is that Spencer early on, actually in the earlier books, like Philip Marlowe, drank a good amount of bourbon, but in the later books, he drank pretty much only scotch. And so I've gone back to Spencer drinking bourbon because I'm a Southerner and I like that connection. And the same way with his food. If you read the books that I've written, he tends to cook a lot of very Southern type dishes that maybe Bob didn't do. But I will tell you an interesting story with that, with the cooking. Years ago, I did not know Bob, but we did correspond, and he was gracious enough to give me a blurb on my first novel, Crossroad Blues. And I'll tell you right now, one of the famous stories also about Bob Parker was he said, "I will either blurb you or I will read the book, but I will not do both." So I'll tell you that he blurbed my book. So that'll tell you something right there. But because he did that, I sent him a set of spices from Louisiana, because my first series was set in New Orleans, Louisiana, and it had all different kinds of Louisiana spices and gumbo mix and all kind of stuff. And there was something that was going on at the time that I kind of missed a book called Sudden Mischief, which was the 25th Spencer book. And I think I listened to a little bit on audio, but I was working as a newspaper reporter at the time. And for whatever reason, I missed that book. And within the last 10 years of writing Spencer, I went back and reread the whole series. And in the book, in Sudden Mischief, Spencer reaches up from a friend of his from the South and picks some spices that he got from Louisiana and uses them to cook. And it just gave me chills when I read that, because that was Bob's little shout out for thanking me for sending those spices. So I thought that was a really, really cool thing that I didn't know until much later, not until after his death.
That's super cool. Yeah. I remember once when he was here, just being working at the store so long, I've had the opportunity to meet, some of these great people that are now gone. I got to meet Bob a number of times, Ed McBain, Donald Westlake, a lot of these guys. But this is kind of going back to what you're saying about he'll either blurb a book, read it, but he won't do both. He was here one year, and I said, "Yeah, have you read this guy Don Winslow?" And at the time I showed him the paperback of Cool Breeze on the Underground. He goes, "Yeah, never heard of him." And his blurb is right there. His blurb is on the cover of the book. It was great.
Well, Winslow turned out okay. I guess he blurbed the right guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see here. Okay, Jonathan asks, is it a challenge to balance the arc of the plot with the incorporation of the well-loved tropes of Spencer and Hawk's friendship and Spencer and Susan's relationship?
Well, again, it goes back to what I hope I've done. I've written 9 Spencer books now, and I am about to next month get into which will be my 10th Spencer book in over 10 years of writing these. And I hope that if you look at each one, could these books survive and would they be published if they were completely different characters? And that's really what I try to do. So, Hawk, Susan, they're all there. They're all what I call my stock characters. Those are my core characters that Bob wrote about. But as a crime writer and as somebody who's has their own career apart from this, is really it's all about bringing in a new story, a fresh story that could stand on its own. If I just said, "Hey, I've written this book and there's a murder in Boston and Spencer is investigating it and whatever," then who cares? What's the point? But if I can bring in what I think is an exciting story, and stands on its own, that's how I get over the mundaneness of it, is to bring in an exciting story, but then have Spencer and Hawk and Susan be a part of it.
I was interested what you said a minute ago about how, your goal was to essentially stay invisible in a sense, and not make it an Ace interpretation of Parker.
Right.
But I think that's a real testament to, I mean, I've told you this before, but I'm sure some of the readers watching would chime in and agree, but, of all the people that, and there've been a few now who've attempted to take over the franchise, I've never heard anybody say an ill word about your treatment of the Spencer books. I mean, uniformly, everybody says, so-and-so might not be doing a great job with Jesse Stone, but Ace does a great job. And I've actually heard some people say they're better than, some of the later Parker. So.
Well, I appreciate that, hearing that. You must not get on Facebook. Occasionally I do get messages from people that say that Spencer is,
rolling his grave.
I've ruined their lives, whatever, but again, I come to, I'm just joking, but I think that for me, I'm a fan. And so yeah. I just want to read a new Spencer book. If you want to read a new Ace Atkins book, read Quinn Colson book, read The Revelators, read, the next, that's got my personal stamp and my personal point of view. I'm just trying to create something that has a continuity to it that feels like those books and gives me the same excitement and the same hope, the same humor. And, it's a little bit of, hopefully, like Barbara and I were saying earlier, a little light in dark times.
Yeah. I do have a question about, somebody's asking about Spencer Confidential. Were you involved in any of the writing for that movie? And I think I know the answer to that question.
I am very proud to say that in no way I was involved in that. I did spend a nice day on the set. I was up in Boston and I was actually researching another Spencer book, and I was treated very warmly by the production staff and whatever, but it, no, I was not asked to write any of that. They had I think this was a guy's first time screenplay that he had worked on, and, you know, did his version of Wonderland, but, you know, that's what happens in movies. And I know most, you know, let's face it, most Spencer fans were not pleased with what happened because, you know, we love those characters, and we even love the old TV show with Bob Urich and with Avery Brooks. And, you know, there is a Spencer that we know and love. And again, that goes back to hopefully what I try to do with the books is not change things, but to continue them.
Yeah. It's funny. Another viewer here, Brett, says, anyone who knows Spencer can see that the only connection is the title.
Yeah, it's a departure. I mean, let's face it. It just, you know, I'm not the first writer, and Bob Parker is not the first author ever to have his characters changed into something kind of unrecognizable. I mean, that's pretty much Hollywood. But I think Spencer fans, I would really love for someday for someone to make something that has the heart and the spirit of Bob's creations. And they're such wonderful characters. And I think it would be just terrific, wonderful film if somebody would do it faithfully.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Quinn Coulson. This is your 10th Coulson, or have you already?
This is a book called The Heathens. And I'm sitting here talking to you on my computer that I am writing the 11th in the series. I've been doing this long. So the 11th book, The Heathens, will be out in July, but, you know, in truth, I'm still working on it.
Yeah. Usually at this time of year, you're in the final frenzy of trying to complete that. Yeah.
This is one of the last virtual events that I'm doing. I think I have one in Boston in a few weeks, but after this, it's tomorrow, it's back to, you know, black coffee and cigars and working on resolution for Quinn.
Can you give us a taste of what we can expect in this new book? Anything?
Sure. I mean, I think that people that know the Quinn books, one thing that is very different about the Quinn books and the Spencer books is there is a connection between all the novels. There is a story there's a larger story, a larger story arc that kind of expands through the books as far as, you know, criminal activity and people that Quinn has dealt with over the years, and a longer story that kind of passes from book to book. And in the last book, The Revelators, was really about a lot of those things coming to head. And in particular, there was an end game with that. There was really an ending to many things that have been discussed in the books going back 5-6 books ago. So this is kind of a fresh start. This is kind of a post Revelators novel going into, you know, hopefully what'll be the next 5-10 many more books. And it's really almost like a standalone story. This is something that is not connected to a larger story. This is a story about a young girl that has been accused of murdering her mother. She sets out on the road with her boyfriend and a trusted friend and her younger brother. And two of my series characters, Quinn Coulson, who's a sheriff in Mississippi, he is investigating the case back home in North Mississippi. And meanwhile, a trusted friend of his, a woman named Lily Virgil, is a U.S. Marshal, and she's trying to track these kids down. And this, again, you know, I always go back to true stories. I always go back to things that I know. And there was a true story that happened when I was a newspaper reporter in Tampa years ago, where there was a group of teenagers on the run for a young girl killing her mother. And this is kind of a Southern take on that particular story.
And what's going on with the TV adaptation?
Patrick, I was really very, very excited, and I'm still very excited, very hopeful. Earlier this year, we were able to announce that Quinn Coulson, all the books had been optioned by HBO, and that a series was in high development. And about this time last year, there was an entire first season of the Quinn Coulson TV show. And a very faithful adaptation of the books. The writer did just an amazing job on the first season, great director. We were all moving ahead, and we were, you know, really getting close to a pilot. And then, the pandemic happened, and it's just halted all production. There's a log jam of projects right now at HBO. And I just hope in the next year or so that we'll see some daylight with this, because I'm very excited. I think this is a good time for, you know, going back to, you know, traditional heroes. I think this is a good time when we take comfort in them. They're kind of like comfort food. We want to, you know, we need people to latch on to in uncertain times. Hopefully, you know, Quinn would be one of those figures.
Absolutely. Let me see if we have any other last minute things here. Okay, here's somebody. Okay. No, I'm not gonna ask you that one. Okay. All right, Joe. Joe, and answer your question. He doesn't have any information on that, but if you want to email me, I'll shed some light on that particular thing. it's some just politics about other books in the series and things like that. Let's see, what else? Let's just chat for a minute. We're both big, as Ace was saying, you know, we're both big music buffs and aficionados, and I don't know about aficionados, just fans. Yeah. And Ace, I got to know him really early on with his first book, Crossroad Blues, about, you know, dealing with the whole Robert Johnson story. And you know all these great writers, like Guralnick and people like that. And for all you blues music nerds, there's a new book coming out about Robert Johnson. And you were starting to tell me a little bit before we got started.
I think, Patrick, you're being very modest. I remember when I first had my first book being published, I was, 27 years old, just a few years ago. And you were the very first to write me a nice letter about it and saying that you were going to be, you know, supporting this book and how much you enjoyed it. And it really meant the world to me. It was the first time I'd ever heard from a bookseller and really had heard from anybody. I don't think I'd gotten any reviews on the book or anything. And it just meant everything to me. But what all that was about, you know, going back to those books is I did find a great, and I still do, you know, I still do. I found a great, I just finished up writing, you know, I don't know where it's going to go, but I just finished up writing a pilot for Nick Travers' TV show. But I found great kind of mashup of hard-boiled fiction and blues music. And I found them really kind of coming in many ways from the same place, and stylistically and aesthetically. And that's really where I thought there was, like, you know, I'd read Dashiell Hammett, you know, and it was like Sun House, you know, and I'd read Chandler and it was like Muddy Waters. And I was like, wow, nobody's really talked about the, you know, these worlds and in the hard-boiled world of, you know, juke joints and you know, murder and you know, all this stuff really kind of spoke to me, and that's how I started writing. I was equally influenced of, you know, reading Parker and Chandler and Elmore Leonard as I was listening to these great blues artists. So that's how those early books came about, and they still really speak to me and really influenced me a great deal. I think I've learned equally from, you know, Lead Belly as I have from some of the great crime writers.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how much, you know, 20th century social history and certainly, you know, race relations, you know, dovetail with the story of the blues and, you know, these tragic stories in many ways. It really lends themselves to kind of a noir tone, noir story.
You know, people ask me, you know, why do I live in Mississippi? You know, why do I live in Oxford, Mississippi? And, you know, this is the crossroads of everything. You know, we've got a wonderful history of music, and then we have, you know, these histories of some of the best writers ever, you know, and we've got, you know, this is the home of William Faulkner right down the street from where I'm talking right now. And, you know, I think about that world, and, you know, Mississippi is always last in the list, but it's always first on the list when it comes to great artists. And for the last 20 years, I've been privileged enough to live here and be around, you know, I got to be very close friends with William Faulkner's niece, and she was really raised by William Faulkner. And then I've had the privilege of coming across and meeting some amazing blues artists like, you know, Honey Boy Edwards. I got to, you know, hang out with him one night, and he was the traveling companion of Robert Johnson. So I think I got here kind of at the right time to kind of commune with these people. And it's been a great deal to me.
Right. Let's see here. Oh yeah. Kathy says, speaking of music, and I think I know the answer to this. How different would a Quinn versus Spencer playlist be?
It is different as night and day. It is different as night and day. You know, I'm going to start, you know, and I do listen to music very, I've talked about this countless times, and I apologize for the people who've heard me say this a million times, but you know, you get your Ella Fitzgerald, you know, your Billie Holiday, Mingus, Bird, you know, that's, you know, that's Parker. And Parker, there's also a great musician many people may not know about who is local to Boston named Dave McKenna, who's a brilliant jazz piano player. And in fact, Parker would mention him in the books. And I start listening to Dave McKenna playing piano, and I just takes me right to Boston and gets me into that Spencer mindset. And then for Quinn Colson, you know, as I've said, my early books, you know, with Nick Travers are very much all about the blues. But for, you know, Quinn Colson, I want it to feel like a classic country song. And so I might listen to some, you know, Tanya Tucker, Waylon Jennings, you know, Kris Kristofferson, you know, that gets me in the proper mindset. So, you know, music is really connected so much to the feel of the books that I want to get.
Right. Well, I think that's about it. Thanks everybody for tuning in and all your good questions. And it's always great to see you, Ace.
You too, my friend. These are weird times, and you know, right now this is the best we have, is being able to connect with people online. But I see a lot of hope coming around the corner, and I think we're headed for better days.
I do too. Yeah. Anything in particular? I remember anything you're reading right now that you're really liking? You turned me on to William Boyle a number of years ago now, and boy, he's going great guns, isn't he? What a fantastic writer.
Oh, he's amazing. I'm reading a new book by this terrific author named Nicholas Butler. I just finished it, called Godspeed. It's going to be coming out this summer, and I don't say this lightly. It is a terrific, I don't know if you'd call it a crime book or novel or noir or whatever, but I'm really enjoying that, or really did enjoy that. I'm reading my buddy Chris Offit's new book right now, and by chance he happens to be married to another very talented person named Melissa Ginsberg. Her new novel will be coming out in about a month, and I'm fortunate enough to be reading both of those books. We have a very deep talent pool here in Oxford, and I've been just kept busy by so many of those people. Another writer who I enjoy very much, Michael Ferris Smith, who also lives here in Oxford, yes, Mississippi, also happens to be a great friend of mine, has a prequel to The Great Gatsby called Nick that's just come out. And it's tremendous. I mean, how many people can write a prequel to The Great Gatsby and pull it off, you know? So I'm fortunate to be here in a very wonderful, community of writers.
Yeah, Ferris Smith is real talent, isn't he?
Oh, he's great.
Terrific. Fantastic writer. All right. Well, thanks again, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. And Ace, I will catch up with you soon. I see you have a conspicuous gap in your Pete Dexter collection. And I actually have an extra copy of, what was it called? God's Pocket.
Kidding me.
No, I'll send it to you.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Pete Dexter, William Kennedy, William Faulkner, the best.
My question, who was the writer you recommended that Ace, blah, 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 William Boyle is his name.
William Boyle.
Yeah,
absolutely fantastic. All of his novels are, and again, it goes back to what we were talking about. They're fun and they're funny. They're very richly written, but they're just some great comedic moments in them.
Right. All right, Ace. Well, hope the family's well and the kids and everybody.
Thanks, sir.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Patrick. Right. Thanks for doing this.
Have a good night.
Good night, guys.
Bye-bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.